better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't. Coming to you once again from Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line from TSPN. That's the Survival Podcast Network headquarters. Today is February the 14th, 2012, and it is a Tuesday. Gentlemen, February the 14th. What day is this? This is Valentine's Day, and if you have a special lady in your life and you didn't do anything for her, you're stupid. Figure out something to do before you get home today, even if she said, I don't want anything this year. Or if you don't do it, you're dumb. You're really, really dumb. Pick up some flowers or something. Do something for Valentine's Day for the people that you love. I know it's a Hallmark holiday in reality, at least that side of it, and whatnot, but I'm just telling you, this is the Survival Podcast, which means I'm supposed to be looking out for you and dangers in your life. There's one I've pointed out. I've done my duty on it. What are we going to do today? Well, yesterday I was on my way up to the office, and the dogs, we keep the dogs right across the street when we're out of town, and we've been out of town. So I came in to do the show. I figured, finish the show, go over, pick the dogs up, and go home. Snow everywhere. No big deal. Snow's not a big deal really to drive in, especially light, fluffy snow. Well, in the approximately 11 minutes it took me to get from the house to the office, I turned into ice pellets, and I didn't know how bad it was going to get, so I got the dogs, got the cat, went home. And some people, I'll save it for a little bit later, but some people took exception to that. But anyway, the whole point is we missed Monday's show, which is a listener feedback show. That's where you send me emails to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with something like question for Jack, article Jack, comment for Jack in the subject line. I get about 400 or 500 of those at least a week that are legitimate, so I only get about 1% of them on the air, but send it anyway. Maybe I'll get it on the air. When I get stuff that I can't get on the air but I think is cool, a lot of times I put it on Facebook and Twitter, so send it anyway. So today we're going to do Monday's show on a Tuesday. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day number one today is BulkAmmo.com. Real simple, folks. If you have a gun and you have no ammo for it, you have an overpriced club. If you have a gun and you have a little bit of ammo for it, but you don't actually go out and shoot it and learn to use it well, it's a little bit better than an overpriced club, but not much. And the minute you run out of ammo, back to an overpriced club. That means you need ammo, you need lots of it, and you need to not break the bank buying it. So you need to carry yourself over to bulkammo.com. You'll get all the common calibers in bulk. You know, it's surprising that they do what they say and say what they do with their name, but bulkammo.com does that. It's all bulk ammo. Great pricing, lightning fast shipping, excellent customer service. Again, bulkammo.com. Next up today, MERS-radio.com. So that's M-U-R-S and then a dash or a hyphen in the word radio.com. Rob over there has some really cool stuff, but he only has a very small assortment of equipment, which means he knows it all cold, which means if you're not sure what you need and you're at his site and thinking, do I need this or do I need that and will this do what I want it to do, if you get in touch with him, he knows his equipment cold because he doesn't try to be, you know, the Amazon.com of radio world. He has the stuff that he believes is the best for the people he serves. So check it out. MERS will let you take secondary communications and combine it with security with the use of motion detectors on your property. For those of you with, you know, 5-10 acres, it really is a great solution. Even folks with quite a bit more land than that, it's really a good solution for. And for suburbanites, it actually is a great solution to let you know when people are like on your front doorstep or trying to get in your gate or your shed. It's pretty awesome the way you could set it up. Check it out today. And of course, it also gives you that secondary communications, MURS-radio.com. Best way to deal with our sponsors, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on their banners in the right-hand margin, and that way you know you're dealing with an official sponsor with my official endorsement rather than a cheap imitator, because they are out there. Also want to remind you today about Valentine's Day being Starbucks 2A for $2 Appreciation Day. Go to Starbucks today, spend a $2 bill, and tell them you're there is a counter boycott to the liberal yuppie jackasses that are boycotting Starbucks today because Starbucks has refused to ban weapons in their stores. Want to say one more thing today. I keep getting these freaking comments that make me want to smoke my own self. You know, as the guy said in that stupid movie, what was it, Malibu's Most Wanted? It just made me want to take my 45 and put it to my temple.
I think we're going into dangerous territory labeling Starbucks as pro-Second Amendment because they haven't done anything other than follow the law.
Shut the hell up. Seriously, what is wrong with some of you folks? You know damn well if they let one store ban one person from carrying one time, we would label the whole company as anti-gun. But when they stand up and do the right thing, some people, I think some of you would only say a company is pro-Second Amendment if they had a guy standing at the front door when you walked in and goes, hey, dude, do you have a gun? No? Okay, here, take a free gun while you're here, and when you leave, turn it back in. Everybody, I think that's the only thing that would make you freaking happy. Look, the guys have stood up. They've been under attack for over 2 years. This is the second time they've been boycotted. Take your ass down or spend a $2 bill. Thank them for standing up for the Second Amendment. And if the barista with the nose piercing and the chain going from her ear to her nose or whatever says, well, I don't say, well, fortunately for you, your employer does. And that means I'm going to keep spending my money here. And that means that you have job insurance. All right? And if you see a police officer or a soldier or something like that down there, hey, pick them up a cup while you're there. Let them know why you're there. Next up, remember, you can connect with me on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Great ways to do that. Just go to the site, click on the links there. Last but not least, do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. You do that, you get exclusive content available only to members, military, law enforcement, active duty, and prior service. Please send me details of your service to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. It's something like military discount. In the subject line, I will send you a discount code to thank you for your service, and that will be a discount that applies to your recurring membership. All right, real quick before I get into your feedback and all, I want to get into some people's feedback yesterday because Jack did not have a show. One smartass said, you would think that a well-prepared survivalist would have some redundancy planned. I do have redundancy for the days that I don't have a show. There are over 1,200 hours of programming on demand available to you at thesurvivalpodcast.com. So when I occasionally have to miss an episode, that's the redundancy. You can go to thesurvivalpodcast.com any day of the week, go to the search menu, and write in any term, and I guarantee you you'll find shows about what you're looking for. Or you can just pick up, go to the archives on the right side. You'll see a listing of months. Just pick a random month and a random show. There is enough information out there that if I have to miss a day, I have to miss a day. I don't like to do it. I always apologize when I do it, especially if there was anything I could have done to avoid it. But I'm not going to put myself at risk just to make some one or two turds happy. I also had some people email me and tell me stupid stuff. Like one moron said, well, maybe today you should just go out there and do it anyway and practice driving in harsh conditions because we don't get to choose our disaster. Don't you say that all the time? Well, yeah, I do. And then one guy said, well, I actually agree with that. You know, going to a parking lot or something where it's safe and doing that and learning how to control skids and all is a good idea. Well, that's fine. That's completely fine. But driving on roads with other people where you're putting yourself and other people at risk when you don't have to is stupid. I had a couple emails. A real survivalist, blah, 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 blah. You know what a real survivalist does? Survives. Wakes up breathing tomorrow. Doesn't take unnecessary risks. I also got some emails from some of you guys up north. You guys down south, one little snowflake. And okay, you're an idiot if you think that way. You've not been here and seen the other people driving in the ice. And that's the thing about the South that I don't think a lot of people from the North tend to realize. We don't get a lot of winter weather. But when we do, 9 times out of 10, it's not snow. Or if it starts out as snow, it turns into ice. Or we get about an inch of ice, and then it compacts on the road, and then the snow lands on top of it. But we get ice. And if you say, I can drive in ice, either you have chains on your tires, or you're full of shit. I mean, those are your two things. No one drives well in ice without something like tire chains, and we don't get enough on the ground here to do that. I mean, you couldn't drive around with chains on your tires here. It just isn't that way. And then the other side of it is we are surrounded by people down here who think because they're rednecks and four-wheel drive pickup trucks that they can do anything and everything on hard-packed snow and ice. Well, in a lot of situations, slippery conditions, four-wheel drive will get you going real good, but it doesn't really help you stop or control very well. So anyone that thinks in any situation that it's a good idea to put yourself and others in unnecessary risk just because you want to prove you're a badass or make some kind of point, that's the person who's not a real survivalist. A real survivalist doesn't do stupid shit just to prove something. A real survivalist thinks and acts rationally. So I just wanted to comment on that because there was some moronic statements. I did get one email from a guy that said, first thing I thought is what it was. Then we were driving down the road, because he's up north, and they had some snow, and he ended up sliding right through a red light, and fortunately no one was coming the other way, or we would have got T-boned, and it was a little less than in humility, and I'm glad to see people do learn. Please learn from the fact that ice slips. Don't learn the hard way, because instead of slipping through a light or having a close call, you may actually have something that's life-altering. I have a friend from school who this day has to call somebody in to wipe his ass when he goes to the bathroom because he's paralyzed from the neck down because he thought he was a badass driving in the ice. I know that's a little harsh for the first show of the week, but let's have a little bit of reality when we go saying stupid stuff. Let's get to something a little bit better, like your emails. This first one comes in from Steve. The email was called Picture for Jack, and I'm looking at the picture. And let me tell you what Steve said first. Jack, this message was up on a hallway dry erase board at one of my Fortune 500 clients. I'm going to pitch the CEO on doing it. This could get a lot of publicity and spread across corporate America. Could you share your thoughts and ideas on this on an upcoming show? And what the picture is a whiteboard. It's kind of a weird whiteboard. It's like rounded. And it says, Gardeners Unite. What would you think about a community garden right here in our own backyard? Thoughts and questions. Really cool. And then the rest of Steve's email, the company has about 3 acres of manicured lawn with a stream running through the property. Imagine if the employees were allowed to get their own little plot, grow veggies and fruits for lunch. How about a few chickens or rabbits for compost? I think it's awesome. And from my understanding, Steve did talk to this guy and the CEO here, and they're going to run with it. They're going to do it. He hasn't told me who the company is yet. But I thought that was a great positive thing to start out with. I don't really have anything more than that other than I do think that, you know, I think about it. Okay, for instance, where I lived in Arlington, when I was in cabling sales, one of my clients was not very far away. It was a company called Origin, a software development company. They have a huge campus. They had to have about 8 or 9 acres of grass. And I look at that and I go, this is very fertile land, really. And a lot could be done with that, even if it's just blocking off a small piece for the employees. But I also look at corporate America and go, you idiots, you're supposed to be making money. Why don't you just plant an ass load of fruit and nut trees and have somebody come in to pick the stuff once a year and take the cash that you can earn off of that? Or give it to local food banks or communities or give it to your employees. All of this freaking land, and all you end up doing is paying to fertilize, poison, and mow it. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity, a tremendously large amount of real estate out there that people could be doing with this. So if you have a company like that or you are dealing with companies like that, hey, just suggest it to them. And Steve, would you do me a favor? If this thing goes anywhere, if they actually start to do anything, keep in touch with me. Let me know if the company would like some free publicity because I'd be happy to hold them up as a test case and say, see, you know, company XYZ did it. They're Fortune 500. They're not a mom-and-pop shop. Anybody could do this. Why don't we step up and make an impact in the lives of our employees and our community? So I love that. All right, so the next one is a little bit tougher because I don't have an easy answer here. Let me read it to you. This is from Eliza. Eliza says, by the way, that's my grandniece is named Eliza. So cool name. Anyway, I am a great uncle, folks. Anyway, we live on 30 acres, which 28 is currently being leased to a local farmer who has rotated 2 crops, soybean and corn. Ugh. I am assuming they are GMO and that Roundup has routinely been used. I think you're probably right. We have free-range chickens, 3 chemical-free top bar hives, and a community garden. Our plan is to reclaim 5 to 10 acres for our use, create a permaculture food forest. We are in Zone 5, Ontario, Canada. My questions are how, and more importantly, at what do I plan to create a perennial-type pasture that would be suitable for some livestock, our chickens, and bees? How long will it take to establish? What type of fencing would you suggest on a limited budget for both time and money? Thank for your time, Jack Eliza. Okay, let's start out with the pasture. The one thing you're going to have a problem with is that the damn fields have been drenched in Roundup. I have no doubt of that, and probably a lot of other chemical poisons as well. And the land is going to need some time to recover. Exactly what you need to plant, I'm not sure. But honest to God, if it were me, what I would do initially is nothing. I would do nothing. I would let things naturally grow. I would let whatever is going to grow as a weed on that property grow on that property. And that weed is going to do a lot to tell me what's going on there. If I find a weed that's really good at accumulating something, I know that, like, let's say copper or magnesium or whatever, I know I'm either rich in it or deficient in it, depending on what type of accumulation that thing does. If it's a deep mining taproot weed that goes deep and mines it from the lower layers of the subsoil, I know that this topsoil is deficient. That's how simple it is. I mean, I had that guy on. We talked about soil testing and all, and I think he brought a lot. Steve Solomon brought a lot to the table, but I'm not totally sold because I understand the biodynamics of how plants work and how nature fixes things. So if I see a plant that's going deep that mines selenium, I know that I have a selenium deficiency, and I may not have to do anything. If that weed successes and is not really prominent in the next succession, then I know that it's done a lot of its job. It's gone down deep and pulled that selenium up. So that's one thing I would do. And I wouldn't get too technical with it. The other thing I would look at is what are the native pasture grasses and clovers and things like that, and what are the planted pasture grasses and clovers that have done fairly well in your area. I am not a Zone 5 person. Even when I lived in Pennsylvania, it was probably zone 6 to zone 7, edgy, you know, zone 6 to zone 7. Because even though it got a lot colder here than it did there, the actual growing season was longer, and we didn't get some of the cold that you guys do in a zone 5. So I'm not real familiar with the vegetation there. But things you can use for reparative purposes that will survive up there would be things like hairy vetch, rye, especially annual ryegrass to do as a cover crop and let it go next year. In your summers, you can use buckwheat to do a lot of repairing, but you might want to let at least a piece of it go for a year. So if you're going to reclaim 5, maybe you take one and actively manage it and let the other 4 just go, because you can only do so much at one time anyway. And you might learn a lot by doing that. Joel Salatin, of course, has said he's never planted a seed in his pasture in his life. Whatever grows, grows. And I think the thing is, though, the guy kind of came up on a farm that was already there and somewhat established, and he just made it better. Rich soil, everything was good to go, and it hadn't been drenched in Roundup because he took it over long before everybody was drenching their crops in Roundup. So that's a little easier said than done there. But I would look to your local extension agency, specifically their organic side of things, and look at it. I would also tell you that one thing that you could do that would probably get you an awesome result would be to do something like this. Let weeds grow for a year. Overseed it, and then don't plow, but roll down the weeds. So they're not even really dead. Basically use like a roller where you just roll them flat. And just roll them flat, not heavy compaction, just so they're bent over and bruised to where they can't grow anymore. So they basically form a mat of weeds on top of the seeds that you've seeded. When your snow comes, they'll be well insulated down there. Those seeds, they'll get light right through that mowed over weeds, right through that snow, and those weeds will break down in your snow over the winter. And as that snow retracts, a lot of that perennial pasture mixes that you use down there will be all happy and ready to go and coming back and come on strong with basically growing through a mulch layer. And it may take a year or two to really repair this, and you're still going to have some residues there, and you're still going to have some challenges, but that's kind of the approach that I would take. I'm not a pasture manager. It's not something I've really done. I'm more of a gardener permaculturist, but if you want to get the pasture back, that's one way to do that. How long will it take? I don't know. As far as fencing, I think that the easily movable electro fencing that's available now is probably your most affordable way there. And it depends on what you're going to be putting there. Chickens is pretty easy. You could tractor them, and you could use them to help you with a lot of this restoration process just by moving some chicken tractors around. If you're going to bring in sheep or goats or cattle or something like that, you're in a totally different ballpark, and I think you need to look at the movable electro fencing then. But that's kind of something that's beyond my level. As far as a food forest, you need to look at maybe working on a half acre at a time. Definitely do some things like some swaling to help establish your food forest. And I would look at kind of your solar exposure and going to, you know, make sure you're going to the right side of the land that you're going to manage so that your emerging food forest doesn't shade out your pasture. that you're going to work so hard to put in place. Let's go ahead and take another one. Zeke says, hello, Jack. I'm a huge fan of your show. Not missed an episode since May 2011. I was introduced by a family member. I live in Chicago suburb. Thanks to your show, Ben. I began to grow as much of my own food as possible. I've been looking into growing mushrooms on logs, but have not been successful in finding oak other than hardwood logs or other hardwood logs. Since you have expertise in just about every subject, I don't know about that, can you point me in the right direction, please? I appreciate your show and everything you do for your community. Yeah, real easy. Call around to some of your tree trimmer type people and firewood type people. And firewood people are often tree trimmers that take the trimmed trees and cut it up into firewood and say, look, I need about 10 or 20, whatever it is, longer oak or other hardwood logs, and be willing to maybe come pick them up, pay you a few bucks for them. And if you could not cut them up into firewood size chunks, maybe, or let me know when you have a job where you're taking out a whole tree or something like that, and we'll work out a deal. And they'll probably be happy to sell them to you pretty cheap. That would be one way to do it. Another way would be whenever there's a storm, drive around and offer to help people. I mean, a lot of times that's a great way to do two things at once. Be a positive member of your community and get some free wood. Fire up a chainsaw and help a neighbor out with a tree that's gone over. Another thing to look for, and it's not as easy now because there's not as much construction, but when they do construction in a lot of neighborhood, you know, establishing a new neighborhood, a new suburban neighborhood, a lot of times they just bring in a bulldozer and just push the crap out of trees. And they just push them into a big pile, and eventually they're going to burn that pile off. If you know where construction is ongoing, new housing development, check there. A lot of times those trees will be available to you as well. Or, you know, the other approach would be to simply look around your neighborhood for trees that are hardwood that need trimming and let the neighbor know that you'd be willing to do a little bit of tree trimming for them for free if you could have what you trimmed off. Those are some other ways to do it. To me, it's hard for me to put myself back into this suburban mindset now where I have, you know, more trees than I know what to do with available to me. If I wanted a few logs, I just go selectively harvest a few of the smaller oaks and let, you know, let the bigger ones continue to canopy out. I have plenty of stuff I could trim off and what have you. So I'm trying to put myself into that mindset for you. But the big thing is ask around. Anybody that would be involved in anything that involves cutting trees, just ask. You might be surprised what you can come up with. This one comes from me from Randall, and there was a big stink made about this because, and I guarantee you that this is in conjunction with a Supreme Court justice that said something stupid about the U.S. Constitution, like some nation, I don't remember if it was Egypt, I think, that was looking to draft a new constitution, and I think it was one of Obama's appointees to the Supreme Court said, you know, they should look elsewhere other than the U.S. Constitution. There's a lot of other constitutions out there to model. So what they're saying now in this article from the New York Slimes says, we the people loses appeal with people around the world. Let me read a little bit to you. Washington, the Constitution has seen better days. Sure, it's the nation's founding document and sacred text, and it's the oldest written national constitution, and it is the oldest written national constitution still in force anywhere in the world, but its influence is waning. In 1987, on the Constitution's Bicentennial, Time magazine calculated that, quote, of the 170 countries that exist today, more than 160 have written charters modeled directly or indirectly on the U.S. version. Quarter century later, the picture looks different. The U.S. Constitution appears to be losing its appeal as a model for constitutional drafters elsewhere, according to a new study by David S. Law of Washington University in St. Louis and Mila Versting of the University of Virginia. That's where I get my information from, people like that. The study to be published in June in the New York University Law Review bristles with data. Its authors coded and analyzed the provisions of 729 constitutions adopted by 188 countries from 1946 to 2006, and they considered 237 variables regarding various rights and ways to enforce them. Quote, among the world's democracies, Professor Law and Verstige conclude, constitutional similarity to the U.S. United States has clearly gone into free fall over the 1960s and 70s. Democratic constitutions as a whole became more similar to the U.S. Constitution only to reverse course in the 80s and 90s. Quote, the turn of the century, first century, however, saw the beginning of a steep plunge that continues through the most recent years for which we have data, to the point that the constitutions of the world's democracies are now on average less similar to the U.S. Constitution now than they were at the end of World War II. And it goes on. You can read the rest if you want. Let me explain something to you. The only thing you need to know is right at the beginning, where it says, it is the oldest written national constitution still in force anywhere in the world. And then let me read you this. They analyzed 729 constitutions by 188 countries. Think about that, folks. That's roughly 6.2 constitutions per country. So of the 188 countries they looked at, they have an average of 6 constitutions between 1946 and 2006. They've changed their constitutions about once every decade or decade and a half. What does that tell you? That what they're doing doesn't work. It's not whether they model it on the U.S. Constitution or not. It's not, see, the word that keeps getting thrown in here, democracy, democracy, democracy. China's a freaking democracy. This is a republic. See, and a U.S.-style constitution doesn't work in a democracy. It only works in a republic with sovereignty maintained by the states. And it's no coincidence whatsoever that as we've lost our rights, as our constitution's been trampled on, as it's been subverted by both Congress and presidential executive order and by the Supreme Court, it's gone neck and neck with removing sovereignty from the state level. The requirements for something like our Constitution to work and to function is that a state like New Jersey or Florida or Texas or Washington or California are seen as sovereign, and the duties of the federal government within the federal republic are outward facing primarily, dealing with other countries, dealing with treaties, dealing with commerce, dealing with trade, and dealing with trade between its member states, okay? And that is about it. It shouldn't be telling states what they have to do or how to do it. It shouldn't be giving mandates to the states. This is what's crippling our Constitution. Not that the document is flawed, that it's not being followed, that it's not being interpreted correctly, and that it's being ignored. So when a nation that never intends to be a true republic in the first place, that never intends to truly grant sovereignty to its member states, put something in it, whether it's like the U.S. Constitution or not, it's doomed to fail and be replaced and replaced and replaced. The only thing that's held the longevity of our Constitution is, one, we fought and died for it, and at least that has been handed down to people. I think our latest generation is less in touch with it than any other previous generation, but thanks to the work of people like Ron Paul are beginning to relearn what they're no longer being taught by the establishment about the Constitution. But that's the key, folks. The key is, I don't care what the rest of the world does. It's not my problem. It's not what I'm focused on. It's not what I intend to worry about. And it's not what our founders wanted us to worry about. Just think about it. Over 700 constitutions for 180 countries over a 60-year period. One constitution for this nation, 1776 to present. Actually, 1785. Okay, there you go. All right, I made another mistake. Email me, tell me. Right, okay. Anyway, but you get my point. Our Constitution actually is as close to perfect as ever has been done. Some people would make a case that the Articles of Confederation left greater sovereignty to the states, and I would agree. I think maybe there was a sweet spot in between the two that we missed. But as far as something that's been put down and used, nothing has done better for more people. And in any point where people want to say, but Jack, the U.S. this or the United States that, or I can't do this, it's all in the face and in opposition to the Constitution. There is another duty the federal government is supposed to look after. And that is, states do have certain sovereignty until the state uses said sovereignty to trample on the rights of its citizens. So if California wants to ban guns, that's when the federal government needs to get involved and go, whoa, wait a minute. This Constitution thing, right? Keep and bear arms, not infringed. What part do you guys over there? No, you're not going to be doing that. You're not going to be violating the individual sovereignty. See, I think everybody has it upside down. They see the most power lying with the federal government, and then the state government, and then the local government, and then the individual. That's not how a republic works, folks. In a republic, the greatest sovereignty lies in the individual citizen, who then defers some of that authority and says, you can look after certain things, local government. And through the local government, turns to the state and says, and now you may look after certain things. And then tells to the federal government and says, and for the things that we can't handle at state level, you shall look after them. But the sovereignty lies in the man, not the state. Capital or lowercase. There you go. So I don't really care if the rest of the world follows our Constitution or not. Unless they're setting up a true republic that recognizes the sovereignty of the individual and the sovereignty of the member states, it ain't going to work no matter how they put it together. And that's why they've had 700-plus constitutions for 180 countries in 50 years. There you go. All right, next one is says, friend of mine was going to get one of these, and I wonder if it would be worth the price to add this light to the prep stash. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. I wish I was doing video right now because I'd like to show you this. This is really cool. It looks like a little tabletop lantern, square, a little roof with some angles on it. The roof has 8 LED lights. Nothing miraculous there except there's no batteries, there's no extension cords, there's no electricity, there's no solar panels, there's no nothing. It's just the little lantern looking thing. Into this lantern, you stick a standard tea light, and you turn it on by lighting it on fire. And then you get the light from the tea light. Big whoop, right? Anybody could do that with a jar, for God's sakes. Here's the magic. The heat from the tea light rises up to the lid of the lantern, and the heat is used to power the 8 LEDs. So the candle, which would be burning anyway, is putting more light out. In fact, this thing comes from Lee Valley Inverteris, is where I see it right now, and you may be able to get it elsewhere, but I'll put a link to this page because it's the one set. Puts out the same amount of light as about 18 tea lights by taking the wasted heat energy and converting it to light. So one tea light does the illumination of 18. And it looks like you got to leave it closed for a while till it kind of builds up, and then that roof thing will lift up about, oh, I'd say a good, looks like about a foot in the air, so it can spread that light out. Seems like great ambience for, you know, dining outside. I can see restaurants with outside dining using these, really awesome. It does cost about $100. When I first saw it, I'm like, I need to buy about 6 of these. I figured they'd be about $20-$30, but they're kind of expensive. I will probably buy one, but I was asked for my opinion, and my opinion is that it kind of goes behind a lot of other things. It's cool, it's neat, but there's a lot of cheap ways to provide a lot of light. One good LED light and a big package of double A's will get you through most blackouts. But this is cool, and anything that would be usable as a candle, such as homemade candles and all, would probably work in it. Tea lights are dirt cheap, and if I get a 1 to 18 return, eventually this thing would pay itself back. It's not going to save a tremendous amount of electricity or whatever, but if you're a person that does a lot of illumination, especially like outdoors, like you entertain outdoors or whatever the candles, it'll pay itself back, and then it's an emergency prep on top of that. So to me, this product fits best for people to go, well, I would buy that anyway. I think that's cool. I want one or two for my tables outside or whatever, or my dinner table or whatever when guests come over. I think it's really neat the way that it works. And it looks it does look really cool. And I think it's really being marketed as like this cool ambiance thing. So I think it's it's a great product, especially if you see it for that use. So it's like a novelty, or like a cool thing, or like a picture you'd put on the wall. It has like an aesthetic purpose. And then it's also a great prep. If it's just for prepping, I think there's more cost-effective ways to do it. But I think you guys are going to like it when you check it out. Darby sends me an email here and says, Darby Simpson, that is, I keep looking at Greece because I think it's a foreshadowing what will spread across Europe and possibly here. 18% acknowledged unemployment. Yikes. This is from The Independent, which is a UK publication. And the headline is, Greece, there's no more left to cut. Thousands of Greeks protest over the affixing pressure from foreign creditors. That's enough. We can't take it anymore. That was the popular chant coming from protesters in Athens yesterday during the latest 24-hour general strike against the country's austerity members. Teachers and doctors joined bank employees to demonstrate against a new round of expected cuts as the cash-strapped country continued to negotiate new reductions in spending to help keep the economy afloat. It's a fairly long article. You can read it if you want to. Here's the thing. The people in Greece right now, and no one has more sympathy for them as individuals, but protesting in the streets is not going to fix the problem. It's like going to a wall and then screaming at the wall, give me food. Give me food now. Give me food now. Like chanting. And there's no food in the wall. You can chant at the wall all you want. Food's not going to come out of it. You can't get blood from a stone is another way to look at this. They're out of money. They're not cutting the money because they want to fix things so much as they're cutting the money because they don't have it. And like any nation in modern society today that's running a fractional reserve debt-based monetary system, once you're in, you're in. There's no out. So one thing that these folks would say is, okay, why doesn't Greece just say, the hell with this shit, and we're going to go back to our own money, leave the EU, tell our creditors, go screw, because you don't have anything to do that with, do you? And it's kind of an act of war to tell another country we're not going to pay you back, especially your own republic. Understand that Greece is in a situation. Imagine if this was California, and California owed money to all the other states in the nation, including the federal government, which they do. And California said, our solution to our problem is we're just going to quit paying, and we're going to go make California bills. It's kind of a problem, isn't it? There's a constitution, and it's not quite as tight as ours is, the EU versus the U.S. Republic, but it's got that. That's one component of it. They are a sovereign nation. They have more sovereignty than a state like California, but they still have that. But even if they did, what are they going to do, start printing drachmas? How's that going to work? What will it draw its value on? See, this is where people that don't get it, that say, I don't get it, this is where you don't get it. Once you're in this, what do? The only way to keep producing more money is to keep borrowing more money. And the only way to borrow money is for the people loaning you money to expect to get it back someday with some interest. The only way to do that is to be currently paying on the debt that you currently have. If you stop paying the debt on the money that you currently owe, then the people that are bringing new money in are going to go, no, we're not going to do that. And right now, Greece is in the same trap people get with a credit card. They've had their interest rates jacked up. Now, it's not like, it's just basically, you don't have to borrow our money, but if you want our money, we're only going to pay you X on a bond valued Y. People don't understand how interest rates get set at national levels. The country goes out and issues a bond, and this is the bond is worth 100 euros. What will you pay for it? And it's a 5-year bond, so in 5 years, the country's saying, we'll give you 100 euros back if you buy this bond today. And, you know, if they're going to do 1% simple interest to make it simple, you pay $95, and then it would be worth $100 in 5 years. You got 1% a year without compounding. Again, just to make it simple. And that's how the interest rate would get calculated. What will somebody pay for it? If they pay 90, then it's, 2% a year. If they'll pay 80, it's 4. Well, what happens when people say, yeah, we'll buy your 100 euro bond, but we're only going to pay you $50 for it? Then you're at 10% a year. That's what other nations are saying to Greece right now. You guys are screwed. We know it. You want our money. It's a risk. We need higher interest, which of course makes it harder for them to pay. Doesn't this sound just like credit card trap? Greece has gotten to where many Americans have with Amex and Visa, but declaring bankruptcy and jumping ship isn't an option when it's a nation, is it? And your citizens depend on you for so many things that you've told them they can have for free for so many years, like cradle-to-grave entitlements, and they're not there anymore. And then the people aren't even able to stand up and do for themselves because they don't even have the infrastructure or the mentality to do it anymore because some of them have been born never knowing another way and always being told, hey, it's Greece, it'll be okay. And that's what's going on. And will that spread across Europe and eventually here? It has to. There's no way out. There is no way out. There are things that can kick the can down the road, but this is where every modern nation is eventually heading, and it's why eventually the money will be rebased and revalued under a new system that will create an immediate inflation spike of 30 or 40% that they'll try to hide and lie about and move us to a new system, and the same people that have been running the shell game for hundreds of years will suck value when they make the change, and we'll all lose. And whether it looks like Greece or Argentina or Weimar or the 1970s in America or the 1930s in America or some variation between any of those, you don't get to decide. You don't get to know. And anybody that tells you that they know is full of shit because there's absolutely no way to know because even the people pulling the strings aren't exactly sure how it will work out. They just know that it'll work out for them and the people will get screwed. And the people will absorb the misery. That's all they care about. And they're off to their new playground, which is the Far East. and we are wadded up like a used tissue, just like they did in Europe. They went here next, they'll go to China and the Far East after that, and then they'll go develop Africa, and by then they'll spin the bottle and figure out where to start over, assuming we haven't eliminated ourselves. That's how the game by the bankers is played, and the only way that you'll ever break free from that is to suffer through creating true sovereignty for your country, which is divesting yourself of debt, dealing with the consequences, and rebuilding from the ground up. Some of the people in Greece that are protesting are calling for that now. I just don't know that they realize what they're calling for and how much worse it would be before it would get better. It would be like a financial revolution. And all the suffering that you would do in a shooting revolution, you would have to do in a financial revolution. The hardships, not having enough. That's why prepping is so important. Someday this country may have to make that choice. If we had a country of 300 million preppers, we could do it tomorrow and get through it relatively quickly and reclaim our sovereignty away from the banks that are actually holding it hostage right now. Right now, this nation's not ready for it. Greece shows you exactly what it looks like. Let's take another one. Okay, this one comes from our buddy Surfviver. Surf, like surfing board Viver on the forums. Cool guy. And I get to meet him, I think, real soon up in New Hampshire. Remember, Liberty Forum in New Hampshire this month, folks. I will be there. Hope to see you there. Anyway, here's his question. Sepp Holzer mentions green manure in the form of ancient grains, and there are many other things apparently used for green manure, though people I have talked to seem to think it wouldn't be of much use compared to regular manure. I have used animal manure, of course, as well. I wanted to get your thoughts and suggestions on green manure. I'm thinking of buying all kinds of things to try, including ancient grains. The soil I have is moist clay with sunny and partial sunny areas. I think the problem is a lot of times if you talk to people, they don't know their ass from a hole in the ground. They don't even know what green manure means. I think that a lot of people, when they hear green manure, they're trying to draw an analogy to animal poop. It's not. Right? And because they try to draw that analogy, they say, would I rather have a whole bunch of buckwheat growing on my property? Or would I rather have a great big truckload of composted cow manure to dump on my property? And since they draw that analogy, and this is the problem in the modern world, it's an A or B, you know, push button A or B. We have that problem at our elections. We have that problem at a consumer level. We have that problem at a farming level. Since they're making a comparison, they write off the B choice if they don't think it's as good as the A. And in this case, in many ways, they don't even have that part right. I want you to think about this. For an investment of, say, $100 for a wide variety of seeds, you could sow acres of land. Let's say we made it expensive and said for $100 you could do 2 acres of different green manures over a season. And then we said, well, okay, when that stuff grows, you know, like I can grow buckwheat to a point where I can cut it down and maybe turn it into my soil. And I can do that on an acre in 6 weeks. And I can do it again and again. I could do 3 crops of buckwheat, turning it in just before it goes to seed. And then I could plant, let's say, something like perennial ryegrass. This is not even a polyculture cover crop or green manure. This is just a straight, let's improve the soil with organic matter. How many tons of organic matter do you think that actually results in? Well, in such a rotation, we could grow about 3 tons of buckwheat per acre, 3 times, through one, starting at the warm spring, all the way through to fall, and then throwing down some perennial, or I keep saying that wrong, annual ryegrass, which can produce another 3 to 5 tons per acre of organic matter before it finally succumbs to the winter. We could till that in the spring. Well, we've now added between 11 and 15 tons of organic matter, and we've done that for a couple $100. And all that organic matter is going down into the soil and being decomposed and broke down by microbes. Now, I want you to think about this. I want you to think about this. When I take buckwheat and I turn it into the soil, even if I'm not big on heavy tilling, but let's say I'm just kind of prepping land that I'm going to use long term and I'm going to go to no-till and I'm just trying to improve it because I've got clay and compaction and stuff like that and I want to do it that way. That's just how I want to do it. Instead of just cutting and letting it lay is another way I could do it. But one way or another, all that organic matter that goes to the soil, either it's tilled in a little bit, lightly tilled, or just simply left there on top and planted again, when I do that, What happens to it? It gets consumed. Microorganisms, worms, stuff like that. What do? They eat it. What do they produce in response to it? Waste. What is that waste? Manure. Green manure is actually the creation of manure using green plant material, because the soil life eats it and craps it out. So it's like you're spreading, 15 tons of manure by spreading, 20 pounds of seed. Which is easier to do? Which requires less work? Which requires less input? Which one is going to be in more uniform spread across the area? Which is going to give the soil more of what it needs? It's not that the horse manure or cow manure or whatever is bad. In fact, maybe it goes in there in conjunction with the green manure program. But it actually works very, very well. As far as ancient grains and all, what Steph's actually doing there is he's going in and harvesting the grain. He's not really using it as green manure, but then he's using the straw often as mulch or green manure or what have you to build up the humus layer. So you have to understand that there's different goals. Most of the concept of fertilizing with manure is about nutrient only. When I do green manuring, I get nitrogen. If I use legumes, I get a nitrogen yield into the soil through the roots. If I do even something like buckwheat or whatever, the green material I'm putting back down to the soil has a nitrogen yield as well. But beyond that, I'm feeding the organic matter layers in the soil. I'm trying to improve the overall soil life and conditioning of the soil. And basically, I'm managing my pond. Remember, the best way to think about managing soil is to think about it like managing a pond. It's almost like if you take soil and put it under a microscope, the life that you'll look at down there almost looks like pond life. All right, next one says, we're building our dream home. Beautiful southern Indiana, and planning sustainable redundant systems for the property. Well water is available. We intend to have an oversized solar wind power system. Considering we'll have our own source of power and water, do you still recommend plugging into the municipal water and power supply as either as redundant backup source or even as a primary source? Appreciate your input. Yes, I do. Especially at the time of new construction, it's probably going to be very affordable as long as you're not like a million miles from the road and have to pay for a ton of infrastructure. So it's going to be affordable to do. You're only going to use so much of it because you have your own systems. But I want you to think about something. There is a major storm in southern Indiana with tornadic activity. Not exactly something out of the realm of possibility. That storm damages your windmill to a point where it won't work, and it's going to take weeks and weeks and weeks to recover it. It also tears down some power lines. As soon as the smoke clears and the debris settles, out will come these little guys with trucks, and they'll start hooking the wires back up. They will not come fix your windmill or your solar panels, but they will turn the grid back on with a well. We've had a situation where the ground around the well actually was struck by lightning. Something created a feedback. That burned out a part in the well. It was like a $100 part. The guy that came out and diagnosed it for me showed me how to replace it. I now have one as a spare. It would be easy to do, but if you don't know what part does that, then you're stuck until you can get the part. It just so happened that that part got zapped by lightning while we were away from our bug out location, and we came up for the time between Christmas and New Year's, and no one was open for a couple days, so we went with only using our stored water during that period of time. So if that can fail, other components of a well can fail. So to me, it just makes perfect sense that if that's available, it's not that you depend on it, it's not that you rely on it, It's that it gives you additional resiliency and redundancy. Here's another question, comes in from Jeremy. Jeremy says, hey Jack, this is Jeremy from Minnesota, and I'm just wondering, with it being tax season and me finally being able to pay off all my debt, which I would like to thank you for, you woke me up and my wife up from sleep. The question would be, you try to invest some money in survival goods or save a little cash or just save the rest of the money you get back in cash. I know not all people get money back, but we are getting some back and paying off all the debt and have some left over money. Okay, that's kind of a lot of words to say a little bit. But basically, getting a refund. My debt's now paid off. I have this stuff called money. I'm not sure what to do with it because it's an unusual feeling to actually have. I mean, donate, put some money in my retirement accounts with automatic draft and everything and have my little cash emergency fund and savings account. But now I got this freaking surplus money. It's showing up and I don't know what to do with it. And I think for a lot of people, when you pay debt off, you don't really understand what surplus money is. And all of a sudden, and here's what happens. It's no different. It's no different than what would have happened like 3 years ago when you had debt. You would have got the money back then and you would have probably spent it on shit. And when I say shit, I mean vacations or gadgets or gizmos or whatever, because you didn't have enough value for the money in your head. This is why paying the debt is so critical. Think about it. I'm telling you right now, people get big refunds all the time and they have debt and they don't put the money on the debt. Now, maybe you do for a couple of years when you decide to get out of it, but also you have the surplus money. You know what it's like to be in debt. You know what it's like to not have enough money. And now you're looking at that money going, oh, damn, what do I do? Do I buy survival and prepping stuff? Do I save it as cash? Do I invest it? What do I do? Well, here's what you do. This is what you do with any of your money when you're not sure what you do with your money. Put it in the bank. There you go. That's it. Stop being afraid of it. I say it about once a week now, and I'm going to keep saying it until people get it. Stop being afraid to have cash. The Fed chairman, between now and like 20-something, 2020 or something like that, has a goal to inflate our monetary supply by 33%, to take 33% more value out of the money over the next 10 years, let's say. That's not enough to make your money worthless, folks. Sure, that's enough that you could say that if you had $1,000 today and it just sat there, in 10 years, it's going to buy you about $777 worth of value. Fine. It's better than zero, isn't it? It's better than debt. Now, I'm not saying not to invest. I'm not saying not to buy prepping stuff. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying that this is the problem is that when people don't know what to do with the money, it's like it's burning a hole in their pocket, and then you make dumb decisions and you do things you wish you didn't do. You sit there and you look at the cash and go, oh, damn, what do I do? Until you know what to do, hold cash. When you figure out what you really want to do with that money and you're committed to doing it and you're going to do it smartly, then spend it that way. That's why it exists. It exists to buy things for you. It exists to provide for you. It exists to set up systems of redundancy for you. But if you're just looking at $1,000 and going, damn, I guess I should just go buy $1,000 worth of long-term storage food and stick it in the attic. Unless you have no stored food, that's a really dumb idea. You might say, you know what, why don't we increase our longevity a little bit with food storage? Why don't we go to the grocery store this week and buy $100 extra of food that we buy anyway? If you're really smart, you might say, let's take $200 and allocate it over the next couple weeks to buy the stuff we eat anyway when it's on sale and build up our pantry. That's fine. You might put $800 in the bank and go, we'll figure out when we get there what we're going to do with it. Because odds are some crap's going to happen in your life and that kind of, so, but let's say it's $5,000 or $6,000. Put it in the bank until you figure out what you want to do with it. Quit being afraid. Quit listening to G. Gordon Liddy on Fox News tell you nothing holds its value like gold. Gold's a great investment, but it's one investment. Put everything on it. You might as well go down to the casino, put all your chips on green double zero. It can pay off real big. You can lose your ass. Right? Maybe you've hedged your bet on a few other things, so there'll always be some payback, but you can lose. That's what gold is. Gold is a commodity. It's not money. Prepping supplies are useful. You need to make sure you have resiliency and redundancy in your life. Now, if you said, Jack, I'm trying to decide. I'm getting $2,000 back, and I really think we need a generator, and that's going to cost $500. I think we need some fuel. And you said, I have a plan for my money. I'd probably say, go do it. As long as you have some money in reserve, go do it. But if you don't know what that is yet, hold the money till you do. It's that simple. And I think it's the bigger lesson here is how people view money differently once the debt's gone. I guarantee you, Jeremy would not have emailed me and asked me to do with his tax refund 4 years ago when he had debt. If he wasn't paying the debt off yet, he would have probably just threw it into his checking account and spent it on whatever he wanted. Next one says, Jack, I'm a college student having a conversation with one of my classmates. I was giving her a hard time and all good jest about not being a good citizen because she's not registered voter and she's not donated blood before. Both issues are due to her, respectively, having just come of age and having just recovered from being ill. After I made the joke, another girl, so he's not really coming down on her, let's see, yeah, he wasn't really coming down on her, it is a he, it's Will, as the guy that sent this, just kind of jesting with her. After he made his joke, another girl piped up and said she had not ever voted because she felt that she does not have the time to devote to researching the issues and candidates before making an educated decision. She said she would rather see people not vote than make a decision that is not well researched. In one way, I felt she was correct, but on the same hand, I feel she and others do not vote at all, do not deserve the right to complain and carry on when something happens politically they do not agree with. So my question is, do you think that it's better for someone to not vote at all rather than make a decision solely from what they see and read on the media network of choice? Love your show. Thanks, Will in Arizona. All right, here's the thing. There's two totally separate groups of people at play here. For the sheeple, this is a cop-out pile of bullshit. If you want to, you know, you could say, like, I don't really have time to research. You should be our county commissioner. But when it comes to your congressmen, your senators at the state and federal level, and the president of the United States, it's pretty easy to know what their differences are just by looking at the information that they put out on their websites and in debates. You could watch one debate, and you could get a feel for who you more identify with and go vote. I'm going to shock some of you now in how I'm going to change over what I've said over the years, though, about this. I'm beginning to feel it doesn't freaking matter. I mean, as long as there's a guy there that I really support and want, sure, I'll get out and vote for him. For me, you guys know, at the presidential level, that's Ron Paul. If I have a choice between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, I really don't care. I know some of you are going to get all pissed off and say, but Romney said he'll repeal Obamacare. I don't believe it'll happen. Do I think Romney would be better for our country as president than Obama? Yeah, I do, but I don't really think it's that much better. Would I vote? Probably because I have a certain sense of civic duty, and I would vote. And probably at the presidential level, I would write in Ron Paul. Or I'd write in myself. Or I'd write in Mickey frickin' Mouse before I vote for either one of those ass clowns. And I know that my state is going to swing one way or the other, and that by election day that's going to happen. And I believe that a lot of people, like this young lady, she doesn't really mean what she says. They're becoming so disenfranchised at the concept of voting that they just don't really think it matters. And then there's a other group of young people that are realizing that they're the future and we are the dinosaurs, and it's up to them to rise up. The reality is one vote doesn't mean shit. I'm sorry, it doesn't. I know they told you that all the way back in civics class, but one vote doesn't mean shit in our system today. It takes a block of voters swinging. It takes a group of people to make a difference. Now, that does start with the individual. But I think that the nation has to experience a fundamental revolution, a fundamental greater understanding of who we are, for people like you and me to actually make a difference in the elections coming forward. That we need more people thinking like us before we're going to matter. We can get out there and vote, and it's important that we do when there's a candidate there. But I'm going to tell you something that pisses people off every time I say it, but it's the God's honest truth. Those of you that say shit like, I don't want to vote for a third party because it wastes my vote. I won't vote for Ron Paul because I don't think you can win. It wastes my vote. Now, I'll tell you what a wasted vote is. A wasted vote is when you hold your nose and vote for somebody you do not want to run your country or your city or your town or your county. When you vote for somebody you absolutely don't want because you don't want him less than you don't want the other guy, there's a wasted vote. When you vote for the lesser of two evils, you're still voting for evil. My wife said to me right now, if you had to vote for one of the three guys that looks like they could win the Republican nomination, what would you do? And my response was, I wouldn't vote for any of them. She said, you wouldn't vote? I'll vote, but I won't vote for them. I won't vote for Santorum. I won't vote for Romney. I damn sure won't vote for Gingrich. And then she said, well, out of the three of them, who do you hate the least? That's so hard. On some level, Santorum, I hate the least out of those three. But it doesn't matter. I still hate them enough that it doesn't matter. None of them are actually standing for what I want to stand for. And Santorum, because of his strict stance on the anti-gay thing, will have a hard time winning younger voters who will gravitate toward Obama, who's done nothing to really help the people that want that stuff. But he's smarter about the way that he says it. So my biggest concern is that we're going to have four more years of this freaking ass clown, because I don't think that any of those three can beat him. I actually think the guy that could beat Obama in the general election is Ron Paul. I really do. I really think he could. I really don't think it's going to happen. God, I want it to. And those of you that are mad at me when I just give the reality on my thoughts of Ron Paul winning, it's like looking at horses. I could have raised a horse from a pony. I could have fed it. I could have cared for it. I could win $1 million if he wins that race. But if he's a 15-1 underdog, I'm not really, you know, going to tell you, I think my horse is going to win. I'm going to want him to win. I'm going to really want him to win. I'm going to love him the whole time he runs, you know. If I'm a parent, like I was, of a 4'6" white kid playing basketball with a bunch of 5-foot black kids, he's not going to be the star on the court. And he wasn't, but I sure loved him when he was playing. I sure rooted for him all the time. That's how I feel about Ron Paul. Love the guy, just don't see it happening this year. But I think Ron Paul's more about the future than this election. He's woken something in people, and I think that's important. Next one comes in from Darby. Of course, after I had Darby on, Darby Simpson, that is, and talked about the chicken factory, some guy emailed me and said that he used to work in the poultry, and it was all untrue and all, and I said, you know, let's have somebody prove to me who's right, because Darby said the chickens are basically dunked in what amounts to chicken poop soup, which I still believe. This guy says that's not the case. They get rid of the chicken for fecal matter. I don't buy that. I worked at a turkey farm as a stupid teenager. But here was one of Darby's responses to the whole thing. For anyone who cares, here are some links to read. Note that over 23% of chicken from USDA-inspected plant can be contaminated with salmonella, and this passes the criteria set in 1996. This is tested by the government as contaminated. Look, if at 23% salmonella contamination rate is good enough for you, then please go ahead and eat a chlorine-drenched chicken. That is what the government is acceptable, be my guest. Note the results from the study are actual plants, and I'll put an article to that. But basically, this is what your government says about chicken that they sell you in the store. If 23% of the chickens that any chicken farmer, Purdue, Tyson, whatever, produces, are randomly selected and have salmonella on them. There it is. It's salmonella right there. We see it. Up to 23% is acceptable. I guess 24% isn't by that. And it's just, you know, this is not like some watchdog group. This is what the government and the chicken producers themselves are saying. It's okay, don't worry about it. And the reason is because, well, if you cook the chicken properly, then you won't have to worry about the salmonella. If you cook it, you kill it. So it's like, you know, not worrying about anything that would be killed by cooking, I guess. But to me, that's not good enough. That tells me that the bacteria is rampant. It's a huge, 20, that means basically 1 in 4. Go take 4 chickens, test the 4 of them, you know, 4 chicken packages off the shelf of your local supermarket, and 1 of them is contaminated with salmonella. All the more reason to deal with local growers and pasture-fed poultry that are not, you know, kept in a chicken house of horrors, guys. Here's another one. This comes from Dave. Dave says, I'm not sure this is so much a question or a rant. I just filed my taxes and got about half the refund that I got last year. Come to find out, they tax the interest on savings bond. Doesn't it seem stupid to loan the government money for interest if they're going to take some of the interest back? But I guess it's a product for another overcomplicated system. Thanks for all you do, Dave. I always found that kind of ironic that U.S. government savings bonds were not tax-free. Now, a lot of state bonds, municipal bonds at the state level, are tax-free. And, you know, I think that there are some states out there you can still loan money to as long as you buy a marketable security that if things start to go south, you can dump, and the interest is tax-free. And if you're looking for that type of interest, I think you can do better. Mike Gazer wants to come back, and that's one of the topics he wants to talk about, some states that sell municipal bonds that are actually still really solid investments, at least for the time being. We'll get him back on soon and talk about that. Next one here from Logan. Logan says, Jack, growing tea, like you drink tea, seems like it would be a great niche market for a local setting farmer's market. I watched Doomsday Preppers again, unimpressed. One woman featured said she would kill her cat in the event of an emergency, as she is scum and should not have a pet. If you agree, please mention preparedness for your pets, maybe a show to your listeners. We have a responsibility to our animals to provide for them. Love the show. Thanks for all you do, Logan. A couple things. One tea. There's certain teas, and you can get some from Rain Tree Nursery that fit this bill, that you can grow hardily outside up to Zone 7. It's a perennial shrub. You pick leaves as you need them. And I think it could be a great market. I think it's definitely people that are like in zone 6-ish could do really well with tea in a greenhouse, especially movable planters that could be outside and only moved in there for protection during the winter. You don't have to produce a lot to actually have a significant amount of money. Tea's an expensive product. To be able to sell locally, organically grown tea, you're the only dog in the hunt, so to speak, so you can charge a little more than maybe you would. So that's cool. The lady from Doomsday Preppers, I still have not watched the new show that came out last week or whatever. But there's a lot of talk going on about this, and you know how I stand on it, and I still plan to do this video kind of telling my experience with the producer. But let me say something about that lady with her cat. I know for a fact that she was kind of conjected into saying that about her cat, that she would kill her cat and eat them. The producers wanted it, so they got it. And that's my problem with these shows. There's also a guy, Desarte, the guy, big fat guy from either Tennessee or Kentucky, that lost his guns. He was on the show. Well, he lost his guns because he was refusing some kind of treatment because he's a fat ass. Not to put him down, but yeah, he's a big fat ass. I mean, guy makes me look skinny when I was fat. And that they said he apparently made some kind of wisecrack about, you know, commit suicide before he would live that way or something. And the doctor reported him, he had his guns taken away. And there's a lot of conspiracy theory that being on Doomsday Preppers made this more likely. I can't say it did or it didn't. I really don't know. I'll tell you this about the guy. I personally don't like him. He made some nasty comments about me when I was doing the 5-gallon bucket project, talking about calculating your fats and your proteins and everything like that, saying that I went on too long. And basically, I told him he's an arrogant ass, and I banned him from my channel, from commenting on my channel. And he made a rebuttal video insulting me, saying that I was basically an idiot. That's fine. I don't really care. I still don't think the guy should have his guns taken away. I still wish he hadn't gone on Doomsday Preppers and been abused. And I hope to hell, one, he rectifies his health, and two, he gets his guns back. And if I got anything in the story wrong, I really haven't researched it. It just made me think of a lot of people have sent it to me. But what I'm really getting is kind of a message from people that are saying that because of Doomsday Preppers, he lost his guns. My understanding, that's not the case, but it certainly couldn't have helped at all. With that, I think we got stuff wrapped up for the day. I have a couple here that I think I'll put into when I'm going to be away and into another show. But I have a couple that I think would really, I'm going to work in real quick here at the end because I just thought they were cool. Tim says, I got a question regarding taproot development for fruit and nut trees. If I were to dig a hole 2 to 3 feet and backfill it with a water-retaining, nutrient-rich, friable mixture. An example would be Mel's Mix, that's from Square Foot Gardening, folks. Do you think the ability for a younger tree to produce a taproot faster and easier would then allow it to use the energy saved to produce fibrous roots quicker? Could this shorten the time frame for the tree to begin production? Thank you for your time, Carpus. I don't know that you'll get much faster production. What I see, though, is, yes, if you dig a deep, long hole, like a post hole, basically, that's several feet deeper than the hole for your main root ball of your tree, and then you fill that with an easily penetrated mixture, like a Mel's Mix or just compost, I have a huge nutrient reserve there that I've created. Two, I have a huge water reserve there that I've created. And three, yes, obviously it's easier for a tree root to penetrate that than hard, rocky subsoil. So I think what that gives you long term is a deeper taproot than you would have normally gotten. And this is really important when transplanting trees from pots because what they will do, they do start to throw a taproot down, but that taproot is not as strong as if that seed were planted from seed. In fact, the people that make the Groasis water box tell us that its ability, its bars of pressure it can exert are reduced by approximately 50% by having to send out kind of a secondary taproot. So it only has half the strength that it would have if you had planted it straight into the ground and let it grow in the ground from a seed. So given that's the case, we want to give it every advantage we can. And to me, it starts to make a lot of sense that maybe if you're going to plant a bunch of trees, you go out and rent one of those augers, those mechanical augers, you know, with you fire it up with like a lawnmower on and it, you know, drills a hole, and you actually go really, really deep. And then backfill that hole until you get up to your root ball. I think that actually makes a lot of sense. And that's one I wanted to make sure that I got on today's show. With that, I think we will wrap up now. I do have a couple more questions. I think I'm going to roll them into kind of a ball with some other questions that have come in. Because I am going to be gone in a week and a half then for Liberty Forum in New Hampshire. I hope to see some of you guys there again. And when I'm gone, I don't want there to be any days without shows like there were this week. With that, I have everything wrapped up today. I want to let you guys know one of your favorite guests will be on the air tomorrow, Stephen Harris. I will be interviewing him in about, let's say about an hour from now. From the time I'm wrapping up this recording, we'll have Steve on, and we are going to talk about solar, wind, all of that stuff, kind of from a mainstream standpoint, what works, what doesn't, what the future of energy for our country is, where it should be, where it's actually going. I'm going to even ask Steve and his thoughts on a couple new nuclear power plants that we just brought online. First one, well, not brought online, licenses to produce, to build them. First ones in a long time that were just approved. I got that from a lot of you guys an email over the weekend, so I'm going to ask him about that. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another episode of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Someday we'll realize our children just can't pay. 'Cause nobody up there cares, they're living for today.
Revolution is you.